podcast this week, we complete an odyssey years in the making, and it brings us to the door of one, Christopher Nolan. How exciting. Plus, the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that, like Frankie Howard, was up Pompeii just yesterday, but unlike Frankie Howard, was up Pompeii with Tom Hiddleston. And even more unlike Frankie Howard, only got 2 hours sleep. Although I'm sure Frankie Howard only got 2 hours sleep in his life at some point. Anyway, hello pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I am joined in the pod booth by 1, 2, 3 colleagues of such lethal cunning. Geek Queen Helen O'Hara is here. Hello, Helen.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good, good, good. That is very, very exciting news indeed. The mad titan of movies is here as well. None other than James Dyer. Hello.
Hi, Chris.
How are you?
I'm okay. I left to get to the office 10 years ago and I've only just arrived.
It's almost like he wasn't listening to my intro.
Well, that's because I was en route.
You were en route.
While you were doing your intro.
Were you lured by the sirens just outside the Mackie D's outside Warren Street Station?
No, I'm friends with Charybdis, so we were just hanging out.
Charybdis, the giant gaping hole in the sea.
Yeah, that's right. Mm.
James loves a giant gaping hole.
Oh, okay, then.
And speaking of giant gaping holes.
No.
Explain.
Don't explain.
What do you know?
He has once again returned to the podcast. It is the one and only Alex Godfrey. Welcome to the podcast, one, and welcome to the podcast, all. Very, very exciting. Yes, I was in Pompeii. I can't say too much about it because I'm bound by embargo. Mm. But our good pal, Tom Hiddleston, has made a documentary about Pompeii, which, of course, is the Roman town that was buried under layers of volcanic ash almost 2,000 years ago, mm-hmm. thanks to our good old friend Vesuvius.
Yeah. Are we mates with Vesuvius? Is that like a choice?
I'd rather rather not antagonize Vesuvius.
Mm. He's mates with Charybdis. So.
Okay, that's fair.
the giant gaping hole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess they both are. Yeah. Okay, that's cool. Yeah. Did they take you to the red light district and did you see all the rude graffiti?
No, we didn't have to. We did have a private... Oh, I can't say. I'll say it next week. No, okay. I can't because I'm away.
Okay.
The week after.
Okay.
But anyway, the documentary airs next week on Disney Plus over here. So, and in fact, T. Hiddles will be, I think, next week's guest. So you'll hear that interview. And then the next week after that, I'll come back and I'll explain what we did and did not see in Pompeii.
Mm.
Very exciting. Very exciting indeed. Anyway, shall we kick things off with a question?
Let's.
Okay. So, the question that has been asked most this week is, would you do a Mount Rushmore of Sam Neill movies?
Mm.
Now, obviously, Sam Neill, the great Sam Neill, passed away this week, suddenly and unexpectedly. And this one hurt, I'll be honest with you. I've been trying to think about why this one hurt. I don't think I've had a reaction to an actor's death like this since Alan Rickman. And part of it is because I'm Northern Irish, and even though Sam was very much a Kiwi, I have this strange thing. He was born in Northern Ireland. I don't know if people know that necessarily. Mm. He was born in Northern Ireland. He moved from Northern Ireland with his family to New Zealand when he was 7 years old, and he kind of began this process of reinvention. He lost the accent. He was, you know, given endless stick at school about his Northern Irish accent. So he lost that very determinedly. He reinvented himself. He was Nigel Neill. He was born Nigel Neill. And he decided that he wanted to be called Sam Neill instead because he hates the name Nigel. Who could ever hate anyone called Nigel? Is what I ask rhetorically. Anyway, so... and I just have this connection. I don't know if you're the same, Hellsbells, obviously being from Northern Ireland as well, that... anyone who kind of makes it big, even if they are tangentially related to Northern Ireland in some way, you know, be they actors, directors, writers, musicians, sports stars, I have a real personal connection to them. Whether it's Sam Neill or Big Liam or Kenneth Branagh or Van Morrison or Rory McIlroy, you know, I feel personally connected to them.
I mean, sometimes we are. Like, there's literally 2 or 3 degrees of separation between most people in Northern Ireland.
And he was born in Oma, which isn't a million miles away from your neck of the woods, right? So, yeah. So maybe you do know the Neils. I don't know. But also, he's been a huge presence in my life personally as a movie fan and professionally as well. So I remember him. The first thing I ever saw of Sam Neill was as Damien Thorne. Alex, James, you might feel the same way as well. I don't know if this is something in The Omen 3, the Antichrist in The Omen 3, where it's this incredibly slick, sinister, suave, debonair Antichrist. He's a real grade A piece of shit, as I believe the Antichrist might actually be. And I loved him in that. And I saw that movie, of course, far too young. I shouldn't have been allowed to see it, but, you know, hey-ho. And all the way through my childhood and all the way through my teens, he was just this presence. Things like Riley, Ace of Spies, and, you know, things like Cry in the Dark and Hunt for Red October. And then, of course, he shows up in Jurassic Park. It's the lead in Jurassic Park. And you just feel this swell of pride. Oh, my God, it's one of our own. That's our very own Sam Neill, who was starring in Jurassic Park. This is absolutely amazing. And then he went on to star in a little film I like to call Event Horizon. People may or may not know, blew my fucking mind and has continued to blow my mind for nearly 30 years now. And when I joined Empire, he was the first ever proper interview I did. And I was so nervous. It was a 45-minute interview. It was for the film called The Dish. If you've never seen
great.
The Dish, check out The Dish. The Dish is incredible. And I've interviewed him on the pod and for the magazine about a dozen times over the years. And every single time, he was a delight, whether it was turning up slightly tipsy to the premiere of Dean Spanley at the LFF one time, or talking about his incredible memoir, Did I Ever Tell You This, for the magazine a couple of years ago, or talking about his accidental penchant for starring in horror films. And every single time I would throw in at least one daft Event Horizon question, and every single time he took it with incredible grace and good humor. And so I think that's why this one has hit me perhaps harder than most. But I also didn't want us to get too maudlin or sad about it, because his was an incredible life and an incredible career. And I think we should celebrate that.
I didn't have as long a history with him, obviously, either professionally or as a fan. I don't know if I knew him well before Jurassic Park. I don't know. Like, I certainly hadn't seen those horror movies before that time. I don't even know if I'd seen, you know, some of the more adult drama stuff that he'd done. Mm. So Jurassic Park was definitely
Jurassic Park.
What changed it for me. And I obviously love him in that. I maintain that his reaction to the first dinosaurs sells the whole rest of the film. If that, you know, if that moment didn't land as hard as it does, I don't think the whole film would work. It's an incredible, incredible, beautiful little piece of acting. And I loved him as well, because he just seemed like a good dude. And
did you
every
feel
time
a
I was
connection the Northern Irish thing, did that mean anything
when
to
I
you?
Learned about it, yeah, absolutely. When I learned about it, it was like a little, you know, bragging thing of like, well, he comes from my part of the world actually. So yeah. Bit of reflected glory, I guess.
Yeah.
And also, he was a delight to talk to, as you said. Myself and Nick interviewed him once. You must have been out of town.
I'm sorry, what the fuck happened?
About Peaky Blinders, and we spent half the time talking about his farm animals and his delightful habits of naming them after co-stars, and that was just beautiful. And I got the chance to speak to him just a few weeks ago.
Yes, that's right.
For a piece that will be in a forthcoming issue of Empire.
Yeah.
It was a little Hunt for the Wilder People reunion for the 10th anniversary of that film. And he could not have been more delightful. And he was the one who was kind of saying, you know, both Taika Waititi and Julian Dennison were sort of going, we didn't really know what we were making with that film. We didn't know if it would land. We didn't know if people would like it. And Sam Neill was just sort of sitting there very quiet going, yep, I always knew. I read the script and I just knew. And you get the sense, looking back at some of the films he's made, something like The Dish as well.
Yeah.
He had good taste. He kind of knew what he was doing sometimes. He's got a couple of films still to come out. We're going to see him in Godzilla and Kong next year, the next one of those.
Yeah.
And there's a film where he plays Daisy Ridley's dad, I believe, that's still to come. So we've got that to look forward to. But yeah, it hits really hard, especially after the news that he was cancer-free and we're like, right, that is Sam Neill in the bag again. We've got him for another 15 or 20 years. This is all good. You know, it felt like a really hard blow.
Yeah, very, 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 very sudden, very, very shocking indeed. Jimbo, Peaky Blinders, in case you don't know, is a television show.
Thank you, yes, I've heard of it.
Yeah.
Yes, he plays Inspector Campbell and returns to his Northern Irish roots.
He does.
Yeah. He's good. He's only in the, I want to say, the first season of that show, but very much synonymous with it when it first landed. For me, it's Alan Grant, really, is kind of where I was first introduced to it. I probably saw him in Hunt for Red October, but I don't think I really registered it.
But I'd like to have seen Montana.
Without doubt, the most I have ever quoted him is as Dr. William Weir.
Do you say?
But genuinely, because
you're
he was
as bad
the,
as each other.
But yeah, but he was the kindly kind of like academic paleontologist from Jurassic Park, and then suddenly he's absolutely terrifying, tearing out his own eyes, yep. And you know, and
you know
Event Horizon, lest we forget, is fucking terrifying.
Life finds a way.
Indeed, oh, no. It does.
Well, we're going. We don't need eyes to see.
Now she has a new crew.
Now she has us.
Now she has us.
I always think it's interesting. There are so many actors would have no idea that these tiny, seemingly inconsequential lines that they uttered one day on set would become part of people's yeah. pop culture lexicons. They're not like classic lines. I don't think Sam Neill, but well, hang on.
Okay, now he's offended. You've offended him, Alex.
What did you just say to me?
This do you see situation,
do you
I
see?
Think possibly
do you see?
95% of your podcast episodes have featured that. It always tickles me to wonder what these people would make of that, because it's not, you wouldn't, if you looked up classic quotes from the movies, that one, don't, it's your face doesn't come across in audio, so I have to describe people, you look like Munches the Scream right now.
To be fair, I think, you know, at least Jason Isaacs, I don't know if Sam Neill ever did, but at least Jason Isaacs has basically said, I don't understand why you keep asking me about this film.
chaos.
But there are these tiny things that we hook onto, for whatever reason, a certain intonation, a delivery, just something that makes us laugh. There's a line in The Rocketeer that I've got a couple of friends where Timothy Dalton goes, bloody amateurs. And it means nothing. And me and my two friends in the world have been quoting that for about 20 years. It's completely...
I'm exactly the same, but with License to Kill, more of a problem eliminator. Or nasty. Just things like that. But he was... whenever I interviewed Sam Neill about Event Horizon, he was always utterly fucking bewildered by my love for that movie. And I think most of the people who are in that movie don't realize the renaissance that its reputation has enjoyed over
in
the
your
years.
Head.
I was about to say,
no.
The renaissance is, I think, within these four walls. I'm not sure it extends beyond that.
Don't make me William Weir you.
I like it. I'm not slagging it, but I feel like
stride
it's...
around this room naked with God. My eyes out. I stress my eyes out.
Your gaping hole.
Oh, no.
Gaping holes in Dr. William Weir's face.
No.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Anyway, there was
Do
a question.
See? Was
this
there a question?
This pod is fucked.
Great Sean Pertwee line, of course. yes, there was a question, Helen. Thank you for reminding me. It was a Mount Rushmore of Sam Neill roles/films. So, Alex, let's start with you.
Okay, so...
Guess what mine is.
Yeah. Do we even bother doing this? It's an interesting one, because my favourite performance of his, and I think his own favourite performance of himself, was Hunt for the World of People. I believe he's gone on record and said that.
You may have a fight in your hands here.
No, but I'm not going to choose it.
Okay.
No, that's okay. If you... I have others.
Does it have the word Hunt in the title?
One of the others,
was,
yeah.
Well, I wasn't going to pick... I was just going to say, I think that's probably my favourite performance, but I'm not going to pick it.
No.
Because, like you were saying, Chris, I think the first... I'm pretty sure the first Sam Neill performance I ever saw was as the elder Damien Thorne in Omen 3. The
Nazarene!
Yeah. I was obsessed with The Omen as a kid. I'd seen the first film... watched it again and again and again on video, wore out some of the grisly set pieces and sequences, bought the book, which I think was David Seltzer's
That's
own
right.
novelization of his own script.
That's correct.
And bought the other books, bought the spin. I thought that I even bought Omen 4 book. There wasn't an Omen 4 at
yeah,
that point.
I did the same.
Liked the second film a lot, loved the third film. It definitely would have been the first time I saw Sam Neill. And he was... It's funny because we know him as such a lovely, kind, genuine, cuddly guy. But he was evil incarnate in that film. I mean, he literally played the devil, more or less, right? And he was so good at it. He was really good at being a smarmy, remorseless, asshole bastard. And... I think I misremembered it, because recently, for some reason, I was thinking about, in my mind, that film ended with him having a fight with Jesus in the street. Okay.
What the fuck?
I know. In my mind. So when I was a kid, I guess that's how I interpreted it. I've watched it again recently, and he just goes into a church and sort of collapses and said, Nazarene,
Nazarene,
you have won nothing.
Yeah.
And then he slumps to the ground in quite an unconvincing way. And then
he gets stabbed by one of the daggers of Megiddo.
He does. And then Jesus does appear and go,
oh. Is that what he says?
Yes.
You have won nothing. Yeah.
So my point is, that was etched into my brain at that point in my formative time in my life, and I've never forgotten it. I don't think the film itself has stood the test of time.
It's not the best of the Omen trilogy, no.
It's not the best of many things. But it was for a kid getting into Satanism.
Oh boy.
Or what, just horror films. I loved Omen so much, and there was like an Omen universe, even though you sort of knew
the Omen University.
There was
I would not sign up to that.
There was only really one good Omen film, but I liked all of them, and he was very, very good in that role. And if nothing else, I will say that is the performance, not his best one, but probably means a lot to me in my life. And I'd like to see his bastard satanic face on Mount Rushmore, because why not?
Hell, there's only a word. The reality is much, much worse. Yes, on Mount Rushmore is Damien Thorne from The Omen 3, The Final Conflict. James, what is your Sam Neill choice?
See, I feel like I want to be considerate. I don't want to take Dr. William Weir from you, much as it would amuse me. So I'm not going to do that.
Don't do it.
Although, That would be probably my favourite. But then also, I don't want to take Alan Grant away from potentially Helen.
I don't think she's going to go Alan Grant.
You don't think?
I
want to be a considerate podcaster.
Mm. That's a good point. Alan Grant should be on there. Yeah. But what if we outfoxed ourselves? And we don't have Alan Grant on there.
This is a problem.
This is a huge problem.
Well, I find that even if you didn't carve him into the mountain, he'd be kind of a fossil underneath it, and he could just kind of unearth it with a little brush. So that would be fine.
Scare children with a dinosaur.
I want to do something left field, something fun. And I remember watching Thor Ragnarok and being absolutely delighted when he turned up as False Odin, or Fodin, as I'm going to dub him. And I just think it's such a lovely little sequence there. And it kind of, quite early on, sums up everything that film delivered. And I remember at the time, and we disagreed about it a little bit, but I was like, this felt to me like the first MCU pure comedy, because I thought it was tonally so different to any of the others. And I know that he's only here for a very small period. He comes back in Love and Thunder. But I love that role so much, and I'd quite like to see him as Odin with the eye patch up on the mountain. So I think I'd put Fodin up there.
This is tricky.
This is very tricky.
For what he represents.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck. Okay.
I mean, I don't see why Mount Rushmore can only have four heads on it. I mean, Mount Rushmore, yes, but like other mountains are available.
I've just had an email through.
Okay.
From the Mount Rushmore Planning Commission.
Oh, brilliant. What
they
say?
They've just received an email from us asking for permission to extend to six faces on Mount Rushmore. And they've granted it. They've granted our request.
They've
Alan granted it. So, phew, what a stroke of luck that was.
Does General Zod add himself, or does he knock someone else off?
He re-carves three of the faces into him and his buddies, doesn't he?
Right, yeah. Okay.
Which, if you think about it, like, that's quite impressive. Like, he's doing all that with laser eyes. I mean, have we seen him carve anything before?
We're getting off the beaten path here. We're discussing the work of the great Northern Irish Kiwi actor and not Terence Stamp. It is a case, if you will, of Neil before Sod.
Good Lord.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed.
I saw that you were doing something elaborate there, and I saw that you were incredibly, incredibly pleased with yourself. Like, couldn't quite work out where it was going until it was too late to run away. So, fair play to you.
All right. So, we have Damien Thorne from The Omen 3. We have, for some fucking reason, Fodin from Thor Ragnarok. Helen?
In that case, I would like to nominate two.
Okay, I'll allow it.
Tell you what, I'll do two.
All right.
Both of them with the word hunt in it.
Really? You're going to go for Hunt for Red October?
And Hunt for the Wilder People.
Really?
Leaving you, I trust you to do Alan Grant.
Oh, that's a bad idea.
Oh, no.
That's a bad idea.
Oh,
because
no.
You're not considering things like My Love for the Dish. You're not considering things like the 1981 horror film Possession, in which he is incredible, and he gives that film like a kind of human handhold, if you will, because Isabel Adjani in that movie is so incredible, and she's so wild in that film. He gives you a little bit something to hold on to.
He's also the human handle, as it were, in...
The human handle?
Wrong. That's yeah. wrong. In Hunt for Red October. Okay, but fine. All right then, fine. I'll do my duty. I'll nominate Wilder People, obviously.
Okay.
One of the greatest roles, I think, of the last 20 years.
Which is?
Which is the role of Heck.
Mm-hmm.
Who is an old bushman who ends up rather reluctantly... he ends up rather reluctantly mentoring young Ricky Baker through the wilderness.
Once rejected, now accepted.
Oh, Ricky Baker.
Yeah.
Anyway, and Alan Grant in Jurassic Park is the best.
What's your favorite Alan Grant moment?
It's the basically collapsing to the ground when faced with a brachiosaur, or I just think
that's it.
Not the bit where he traumatizes a small boy at the beginning by threatening to disembowel him.
Honestly,
with
the small
raptacle.
Boy had it coming. He had it coming.
He only had himself to blame. If you would have been there, if you would have seen it, then I bet you would have done the same. Little kid from Jurassic Park. Oh. Alex is looking at me as if I've lost my damn full mind.
You said at the beginning of this, we don't have a lot of time today.
Oh, yes.
That's right.
Anyway, but Jimbo, he also traumatizes, Alan Grant, obviously one of his big things is that he doesn't like kids. And he just traumatizes motherfuckers left and right and center in that movie because he also traumatizes Tim and Ellie, doesn't he? When he pretends to be electrocuted.
But he also...
But I know he warms to them.
Yeah,
but,
and he also saves them, importantly. Like, he does, you know, ultimately, save their lives. Like, okay. He gets some points for that.
All right, Helen, after careful consideration, I've decided to endorse your choice of Alan Grant and Heck from Hunt for the Wilder People. All right, as the fifth and sixth characters on our epic, elongated, gatefold Sam Neill Mount Rushmore... I have to go for Dr. William Weir.
I know you do.
He's one of the great bad guys. His arc, Helen, if you will, is tragic.
Mm.
It's a tragic arc.
It is.
He is consumed by his own creation. He starts off as the audience's eyes and ears. We think he's the hero.
Of course we do.
You know why? He's played by Sam Neill, the nice guy from Jurassic Park. But we forgot, he was also the bastard Antichrist.
No!
Oh my God. And then Dr. William Weir becomes slowly seduced by the event horizon and corrupted by it and then possessed by it. And then he rips off his clothes and is covered in weird scars and tattoos and spooky shit and rips his own eyeballs out and starts running around waving his willy about.
I think some other bits as well, actually. I think he rips off those bits.
Do you think he rips off his willy?
Apparently, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I remember the line now. Well, we're going without any willies to piss. Is that what he says?
It's something like that.
Something like this. All right, okay. It's exciting.
Okay.
All right, so the sixth, Sam Neill. I mean, we haven't mentioned the piano.
Yeah.
And he's really good.
I think
really
we're losing the point of Mount Rushmore here. We can't just do the whole IMDb.
But you heard the email. We've got permission.
We got the email.
Wait, sounds like we're going beyond six.
We have to mention some films. We have to at least give the impression that we're considering them. It's The Dish.
I don't know if everybody out there has seen The Dish.
Yes.
It's a very
dimension
small...
Dimension of pure chaos, pure evil.
It's a small Australian film, and
yes.
It's about the radio telescope that helped to receive the pictures from the moon landing in 1969. So you've got this tiny radio telescope, or not tiny, a very big radio telescope in the middle of this tiny town in Australia, and Sam Neill plays basically the boss of the Dish.
He plays Cliff, and he's going to be on a cliff.
Yeah, and he has a pipe and a cardigan, and he's just the most avuncular man
movie
history.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just lovely. I think this runs a gamut, right? So we have absolutely maniacal bastard murderers. We have satanically possessed people. We have...
Gruff bushmen.
We have gruff...
And indeed paleontologists.
We have paleontologists. Do you think Alan Grant was a bushman as well? Anyway, okay. We have... What else do we have? We have other people.
We have an actor.
An actor.
James, your choice gets weirder and weirder.
I was being... considerate.
You were
being
very considerate.
And not taking one of the good ones.
I would have just mentioned something else. It's fine.
I could have done.
But anyway, the man was a legend, an absolute legend, and he deserves many, many more faces on Mount Rushmore. He will be very, very, very sorely missed indeed. The great Sam Neill. Look at him. Isn't he beautiful? All right, we're going to take a quick break now, and we will be back in 2 seconds, unless, of course, you're an Empire Plus subscriber, in which case we'll be back immediately after some words from these folks. Enjoy. Okay, we are back, folks. We are back. And of course, if you are an Empire Plus subscriber, then you heard no adverts. And if you're not an Empire Plus subscriber, then you should perhaps consider subscribing to Empire Plus, which is our new subscription-only channel in which you will get ad-free versions of all Empire podcasts, plus access to our Spoiler Special archives, over 500 episodes and counting, plus more every month, plus new shows, a dedicated Mount Rushmore show. By the way, that is the thing, that I've kind of retired Mount Rushmore from the main show to give it its own episodes over on the Empire Plus paywall. But I felt that Sam Neill, there was such a, you know, people were crying out for it. So I felt that we would take it out of retirement just for Sam Neill. What else do you get? You get episodes of The Ranking. You get other stuff as well that'll be coming to you every single month for just, what's it now at the moment, Jimbo? I think you have maybe another week to go for £3.49.
Yes, the 27th is...
27th of July.
Is price hike day.
It is.
We're so sorry.
But also the day you can subscribe to a bundle that gives you Empire and Pilot Plus as well.
That is true.
That's very, very true indeed. So, you know, six of one, half a dozen of the other, I guess. And while I'm shamelessly plugging things, we should mention once again our live show at King's Place on Saturday, September 5th. It's part of the London Podfest. We do a London Podfest show every single year. It is always a hoot and a holler, and we would love it if you could join us there. Tickets are on sale right now, kingsplace.co.uk. Helen's going to be there. James is going to be there. I don't know if Alex, are you free that evening? You're going to come along?
Who knows?
Who knows?
Ooh, the mystery element.
I love when he plays hard to get.
It's only with you. Everyone else, I'm easy.
All right, fair enough. So yes, kingsplace.co.uk to get your tickets for that one. And anyway, should we talk about movie news?
Yay.
What has been happening in the world of movie news, folks? I've been in Pompeii, I don't know if I mentioned it, and I haven't really been paying attention to anything.
Well, I think you know about one of the stories, because one of them is the trailer for Digger, which dropped this week.
Which I was very disappointed to hear was not a Digger Bonds origin story movie. No? No Dallas fans in the house? Okay,
that's,
as you were.
That's why John Barnes' nickname was Digger at Liverpool. I have just put
I've just put that together.
John Barnes, until Mo Salah came along, was my favourite Liverpool player of all time. And when he moved to Anfield in 87, he moved to...
Peak Dallas time, yes.
That explains it.
Digger Barnes.
Digger Barnes.
Who was Cliff Barnes' dad.
Oh my God!
Yeah.
That's amazing. There was also a footballer called Fitz Hall, whose nickname was One Size.
That's very good.
That's very good. Isn't it?
I saw a basketball player today who has some of the best nicknames I've ever seen. He is a white basketball player who wears glasses on the court, like sort of almost like they look
Stephen
like goggles.
Merchant.
So he's got names like Larry Nerd.
Bird.
Yeah, and
Larry
and Bird. like honestly, every one of them is pretty great.
But one Helen used was disappointing. But I'm sure
but all the
other ones would be great. And I was like, you motherfucker, you were away last week in LA, and I was away last week in LA. And where was I? I was at a Digger trailer event at the Warner Brothers lot. Where Tom Cruise himself introduced the brand new trailer a few days before it hit the internet of Digger, which is the movie he's been making for a while with Alejandro. Helen, you can always say this name much better than I.
Alejandro González Iñárritu?
Him.
Yeah, that's him. Him.
Yeah.
I just say Iñárritu and it doesn't sound as... Helen attacks the Spanish language with real grace.
With a certain exuberance.
Speaking
of very obscure quotes, Alex.
We're doing a podcast with the inventor of Scrabble. But yes, so this is a film in which it's been kind of under wraps. We knew it was about someone, a very powerful person played by Tom Cruise, who in some way triggered some sort of cataclysmic event and then was tasked with averting the after effects of that event. We know a little bit more about it now. He plays a guy called Digger Rockwell, who appears to be some sort of billionaire oil, I'm guessing oil baron slash tycoon, who in the course of one frack too many, seems to unleash some sort of cataclysmic event upon the earth and is tasked with by the President of the United States of America, played by John Goodman, with reversing the effects of this. And hilarity follows. And the interesting thing about this is, for an Iñárritu movie, it's a comedy. It's an out-and-out Doctor Strangelove-esque, at least this is my impression from the trailer, Coen Brothers-esque comedy. It literally says in the tagline, a comedy of catastrophic proportions. And Tom Cruise is buried under layers of makeup. But the tone of this thing is really interesting. It's like a far removed from something like The Revenant or even Birdman, which was kind of a black comedy as well. But
apparently.
That's going to be the question. Like, does the tone work, I think, when we see the full film?
Yeah.
It's hard to tell from a trailer if that kind of particular sort of farce works. Like, the Coen brothers can do it, but people even hate it when they do it sometimes. And it's going to be interesting to see if this one works. I mean, it's an incredible cast around him as well. You know, Riz Ahmed and Michael Stuhlbarg and Jesse Plemons and Sandra Hüller, like, great, great people. So I'm really optimistic. I think people are talking like this is Cruise's Oscar grab. And maybe there's an element of that. I think people get suspicious anytime a big actor puts on a lot of prosthetics. But they made a point, I noticed, in the sort of press release for this trailer, of pointing out that he's already an Oscar winner. He has his honorary Oscar that is in the bag. So I feel like they're trying to kind of tamp down on that chat about this film. It's interesting to me, I thought.
I didn't see, it's not an Oscar-baity sort of trailer.
It doesn't feel like that.
And it is a comedy. I mean, comedies don't often win big at the Oscars. I think because it was an Iñárritu film, people were expecting something sort of weighty and more dramatic. Mm. But, you know, you watch a trailer and you're like, well, this is sort of Tropic Thunder territory. And it's very Tom Cruise. There's a lot of woo, you know, all that stuff. And it looks like a big performance. It looks quite broad. It looks definitely, obviously comedic. So I don't know. I think it's probably...
I think there'll be more to it than that, I think, ultimately.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously social, political sort of material, but it looks like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And actually, there are layers and layers of makeup on there, but I don't think they're ghoulish prosthetics.
No,
you know,
it could have been grotesque and it's not.
Yeah, they're very natural.
Well,
and I think you totally... Like, there's nothing in there that obscures him at all. Like, he can definitely... It doesn't look like he's wearing a rubber mask. And you can definitely see Tom Cruise there. It's not that hidden. And they've obviously done that on purpose. He wants to be able to emote under all those prosthetics. But it looks really fun and really, really interesting. And remember, it's not, you know, it's an Iñárritu film as much as anything else. And you never know what you're going to get from him.
No, indeed. That's all we know, really, at this point in time. But yeah, it's out in October. So hopefully more, in fact, more will be revealed in October, in fact.
Yeah.
But more will be revealed, I'm sure, over the coming weeks and months. But yeah, very, very promising start indeed for Tom Cruise is Digger, which I believe is the name of the film. any other trailers that did I go to any other events? Did I see any other launches?
I don't know about you, but there was a trailer for Mayday.
Mayday.
Which is a film where Ryan Reynolds is a fighter pilot type who is shot down in Cold War Russia.
That's Rodney Reynolds to you.
Indeed. And teams up with Kenna, I'm doing my accent again, Branna, speaking of boys from our neck of the woods, as a Soviet former KGB agent type person who is a very big fan of American culture and tries to help him get home.
Mm-hmm.
This looks like a totally fun time at the movies. It looks like it might be very stupid, but I'm kind of here for that.
This is from John Francis Daly and Jonathan Goldstein.
It is.
Who are better known as John Francis Daly and Jonathan Goldstein, the directors of Game Night and, of course, Dungeons and Dragons, Honor Among Thieves.
Yeah,
this is their big follow-up to that movie. And this is an original film written by them, directed by them, and it looks very, very promising indeed. Mm. I've written a piece for the magazine already talking to the directors about this and about how it is not quite what you expect from that lineup.
All right.
And yeah, it looks very, very promising indeed.
I'm totally sold on it. Don't get me wrong. I think it looks silly, but open brackets, complimentary, close brackets.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay.
It looks fun. It's like, you know, it's an odd couple with fisticuffs. Maybe a Midnight Run energy somewhere in there.
Well, that'd be nice, wouldn't it?
Did you see the Nova news?
I did see the Nova news.
So
I'm looking at it right
Waldron
now.
Michael Waldron is apparently working on adapting a Nova movie because it turned up on his WGA card. So kind of the cat is out of the bag. This has been in, well, I say been in development for a while. There was talk of a TV series for quite a while. Mm-hmm. But now Michael Waldron of Loki fame is involved and it's being developed as a movie. Whether it will actually happen or not remains to be seen. I guess they're going to put together a concept, put a script together and then see if it will work.
Shall we explain Nova is?
I see. I was hoping you weren't going to ask me that because I know that Nova has
a Marvel Cinematic Universe movie, by
right? Me. Nova has a dashing helmet with a star on it. Is a member of the Nova Corps. But I must admit, though, that kind of galactic thread of Marvel, I never read any of the comics for. So I never read any of the Guardians comics. But it's very much of that ilk.
I read a few back in the day, and he would show up in things like Guardians, obviously, and Silver Surfer and whatnot. And I think he had his own comics a few times, maybe.
Yeah,
and the interesting thing about this is, of course, that Comic-Con is next week in San Diego, and we know that it's going to be a Marvel Studios presentation in Hall H on Saturday afternoon, as is tradition, and we expect that's where we're going to see the first real look at Avengers Doomsday, and we expect that's where they're going to show the whole bunch of the cast, and we may get the first look at Robert Downey Jr. as Doctor Doom and all that stuff. But it's also where I would not be surprised if Kevin Feige took to the stage and announced the next phase of the MCU. And this movie might be one of those movies. You just don't know. But it would not surprise me if he took to that stage, and because there's nothing at the moment in between Doomsday and Secret Wars, which is, so Doomsday is December, and Secret Wars is meant to be next December as well. Now, they made that work with Endgame. Whether they'll make that work with Doomsday and Secret Wars remains to be seen, but there's nothing in between. Now, that might be their approach, because, or they might have been filming things in secret for a while, and they might be in a position to go, hey, Ryan Coogler is making Black Panther 3 as we speak, and it's coming out next May, and we also have Thor 5, and we also have a new Guardians of the Galaxy movie, and because I think they're going to go down the route of heavy hitters, recognizable names, Doctor Strange 3, things like that, rather than taking gambles on stuff. But I would love them to do Shang-Chi 2, as I have often said in the podcast. And the fact that they're developing a Nova movie means that they haven't totally closed the door on, less well-known properties in the Marvel Comics universe. So I expect that to happen. I'll probably be completely wrong. I know someone who's going to be in San Diego next week at that panel at Hall H, so I will report back. Staying with superhero news, Blue Beetle is returning.
Yeah, who saw this?
It's the return we've all been waiting for.
Everybody's been talking about it.
I am so glad I can get on with my life now. I really am. Now that Solo Maraduena is going to return as Blue Beetle in Superman Man of Tomorrow, which does appear to have everybody in it, and I mean everybody in that. So obviously David Corenswet as Superman, Nicholas Holt, Nick Holt as Lex Luthor, Rachel Brosnahan as Lois Lane, who else is in it? Hawk Girl, Isabella Merced,
Millie Alcock
as Supergirl, Nathan Fillion as Guy Gardner, Eddie Gathegi as Mr. Terrific, Adria Arjona as Maxima, who may be Wonder Woman, we don't know. Aaron Pierre is going to be in it as John Stewart, not that one. And it's stuffed to the gills. But Blue Beetle was part of the previous DCEU, and the movie came out and it was decent, but nobody really saw it. And we thought we'd seen the last of the character, but no, he's back.
It's an odd one to resurrect, isn't it?
I think James Gunn liked that movie and felt maybe a bit bad that he got, you know, kind
maybe
of kicked out of existence.
I don't know. Like, a cynical part of me reads a certain amount of desperation in all this. Like, they are throwing everything at the wall to desperately salvage the whole DC thing, which is going off the rails rapidly.
I don't know how you could say that when Doomsday has every Marvel character that's ever been.
And you could 100%, and let's be honest, probably should make the same accusation there. Like, there is an element of desperation to that too. But I have a certain amount of faith that that one will pay off. This one.
Yeah, I'm not sure that desperation leads you to Blue Beetle as your savior. I mean, the film...
He's here to save us, Helen.
The film did somewhat bomb at the box office, it's fair to say.
It was fine.
No, I didn't say bombed at the box office.
It did.
And you know, he's a young actor, he's kind of up and coming, he's in Practical Magic 2, guys. So,
is he?
Yeah. And it just feels like maybe, you know, he deserves maybe another chance in a way that, and the character maybe could have another go round.
He's a great actor. He was amazing in Cobra Kai. He's really, really good.
Yeah,
really
he is good. That, yeah. He is good.
The weirdest thing about it, I think, is that James Gunn's new DC universe is just all over the bloody shop.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, it's supposed to be a clean slate, but here he is resurrecting characters from the older iteration, yeah. And there's Batman films coming out which have nothing to do with it. I mean, it's just, it's still sort of really splintered, isn't it?
Yeah.
Splinter technically is Marvel.
Yeah. Boom. Make sense? I'm hoping it'll make sense. And maybe he's just playing the character again and it's not linked to what he did before.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it could be that. Batman Part 2, by the way. Reeves' Batman Part 2 has been pushed back.
18th of April 2028.
Okay. He's filming right now.
Yeah.
Matt Reeves shared a little glimpse at it today on his Instagram. Looks cool. Looks moody.
Looks like the Batman.
Looks like the Batman.
That looked like a shot to me that was made for a teaser.
Yeah, yeah, I think very much so.
That's 6 years between films. That's quite the wait.
Do you think that's too long?
I don't know, it's not really too long. There's certainly been longer ones, but it does feel like it already feels like it's been ages since The Batman. And it will certainly feel like ages by February 2028. It's been a lot of horror stuff.
Yes.
There's been the shot of the new Carrie TV series that Mike Flanagan's doing.
Which will be Comic-Con next week.
As to how they're going to stretch that out over the series, but I'm cautiously optimistic, and I like Mike Flanagan a lot. And then there was the Nightmare on Elm Street news.
Yes.
You see that? That's possibly wrong-headed, but the whole idea is they are... I'm not even sure if they're rebooting it so much as possibly remaking the original movie, because seems to be what's happened here, that Paramount have got the rights from Wes Craven's estate to kind of the screenplay of the original 1984 movie. So they're going to do something else with it. Obviously, the remake from, what was it, 2010 with Jackie Earle Haley?
They did a lot of new things with that.
They did, yeah. It was kind of much more dialed into the child abuse angle, wasn't
it? Yeah, remaking the original would be interesting because it was a classic of sorts in its own right at the time, but it was Freddy before he became too comedic.
Yes.
Before he was the
Freddy as an actual monster rather than a kind of, you know, figure of fun.
Yeah, which is what they did do with Jackie O'Haley, but maybe too far in that direction. It would be interesting what they do tonally. I mean, I have mixed feelings about it because, on the one hand, leave Freddy alone. There were a lot of them. I don't think you can really top what Robert Englund did. And they were so entertaining, those films, when they were good.
Some of them.
A couple of them were very good. The rest of them, I'm not sure, but I still watched them a lot.
1, 3, and 7, let's be honest.
Okay, and...
2. I'll bat for 2 as well.
2's fun. Good set pieces. But on the other hand, it's such an iconic horror character, and it's been enough time. You could do it again. They do everything else again. I mean, it depends what they do and how they do it.
I'd be interested in a, you know, relatively faithful remake of the original film, kind of updated to kind of modern horror aesthetics. Because again, I feel like it's a film that's fantastic and it is a classic, but it does show its age quite a lot. And I wonder if you want to bring in a kind of a young horror audience who are kind of weaned on things like Obsession and Batrooms and stuff, then this might be an interesting
thing. Well, it's a great idea. You know, you've got a killer killing kids in their dreams and it's a brilliant monster. I mean, there's a lot of potential to do something good with it again.
Yeah, I agree. Helen, do you have any affection for the bastard son of a thousand maniacs? You've worked with James long enough now, I guess.
It's fine. I don't have that attachment to it. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Whatever.
You just think that Freddy Krueger, he's up to no good.
I stand by that assessment of him overall. Overall, I think he is up to no good.
Yeah.
And pesky, and I don't approve. There you go. I said what I said.
I said
What?
I said what I said.
Two Freddy's coming for you. Three for better lock your door.
He's a monster.
Five, yep, he's going for the whole song.
Six, grab crucifix.
Skipping rope is a bit much.
Seven.
Oh no.
And the dresses.
And the little white dress, yeah. I mean, it's...
Stay up late.
Chris has had 2 hours sleep.
Nine, ten.
Never sleep again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
this from someone who literally hasn't slept. So is that the reason why
you're
afraid that
2 hours
will get you?
In the hotel.
Mm.
Of what?
I had 30 minutes on the plane.
Of what?
And 25 minutes when I go back to the flat today.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Adding up, that's more than 2 hours. So I think I'm feeling pretty. Anyway, I think that's it for the movie news section. Don't you agree?
I do.
So, should we have a guest?
Yes.
Really flagging. Shall we have a guest? Let's have a guest. Shall we have the director of The Odyssey? Shall we have the writer-director of The Odyssey?
My God.
Shall we have the benighted writer-director of The Odyssey?
Very well.
Shall we have the Oscar-winning benighted writer-director of The Odyssey? Chris Nolan's basically what I'm saying. Christopher Nolan, of course, to his friends. Who can forget his classic theme song? No, okay. So he is, of course, the writer-director of The Odyssey. Listen, I'm fucking tired. I am so tired. I don't know what's happening anymore. Anyway, The Odyssey is out this week and it's been many, many years in the making, and it is based on the epic poem by Charles Brandreth, and it is a story of one man, Odysseus, played by Matt Damon, who gets involved in a little skirmish outside Troy. Helen, you're the historian here. You can correct me if I'm getting any of this wrong.
So far, no. I'm poised.
And there's a horse. There's something to do with a horse.
There's something to do with a horse.
Yes. Thoroughbred of fear.
and then after the skirmish at Troy, right, he tries to get home to his wife, Penelope, played by Anne Hathaway, and his son, Telemachus, played by Tom Holland. Not the historian. Not
correct.
James's Roofer. Not the Ipswich Town footballer, former Ipswich Town footballer, but the guy who plays Spider-Man. And it takes him ages because he misses his bus at Reading.
No.
And he encounters along the way, he and his men, a lot of obstacles. Only Christopher Nolan could have made this movie. It was shot practically, incredible cast. Who have I not mentioned? John Bernthal, Zendaya, Charlize Theron.
Lupita Nyong'o.
Lupita Nyong'o.
Mia Goth.
Robert Pattinson. Benny Safdie.
Elliot Page.
Elliot. Oh, it just the big names just keep on coming. And it is absolutely splendiferous, as you will see in the review section. And I was delighted to sit down with Chris Nolan in a London hotel room a couple weeks ago, and we had a good old natter about this movie. Enjoy. Christopher Nolan, welcome to the Emperor Podcast. How are you?
I'm good. Good. Good to see you.
Yeah, likewise. You're at the end of your Odyssey. How do you feel? Are you exhausted? Have you had the crash yet?
I was going to say I'm at the beginning of the end.
That's what Churchill
would call it, yes, or the end of the beginning of the end. I make films for the cinema. I make them for the audience. And so for me, the film isn't finished until the audience has told me what it is. So this is it's a very nervous time for me.
So what is this time like for you then? Do you watch the film with audiences once it's released? Do you sneak into screenings to see how it's playing, where it's playing?
Yeah, I mean, it's daunting, but you know, Emma and I will sneak into the back of a cinema when it opens and, you know, sit through some of it. We've always done that. It's always important to sort of see it with an audience. But it's scary. You know, it doesn't get any easier.
So this is the beginning of the end of The Odyssey for you. What was the actual beginning for you? Because I know this has been on your mind for a long, long time, and you came close to directing Troy all those years ago.
Yeah.
But were you working on this, say, before Oppenheimer, or did it really begin to gather pace after Oppenheimer?
No, I do one thing at a time. Some filmmakers develop 10 projects at once and whichever one goes, you know, that kind of thing. I've never been like that. I do one thing at a time. And so my development process is years previous. You know, 20 years ago, I almost directed Troy. I had to figure out what I would do with the Trojan horse. Mm-hmm. I came up with this idea of having it half buried in the sand, about to be swept away by the waves, sort of like the Statue of Liberty at the end of the first Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
Like a fallen monument.
Yes.
That was the idea. It stuck with me for 20 years. I still wanted to do it. I desperately wanted to do it. And so coming out of Oppenheimer, with the tremendous and unexpected success of that movie, which was thrilling, and it also gives you an opportunity. It's like they're going to let you do something that they wouldn't normally let you do. That's the way the system works. Mm. And I thought, okay, let's get the Odyssey on modern cinema screens. So that'd be something to do.
This is a film about a man who has literally lost his way. We are reminded of that constantly during the Odyssey, that Odysseus has lost his way, literally and figuratively as well, of course. You strike me as someone who doesn't necessarily lose their way creatively. Is that the case? Or were there moments during this where you thought, I can't see the wood for the trees? This is a huge undertaking.
I think both things can be true in a strange way. I mean, different filmmakers work differently. For me, a sense of control is important and essential. I don't work well in chaos.
Yeah.
But within the control, what I've tried to put together with all my collaborators, you know, in particular, Hoyte van Hoytema, my director of photography, and Ruth de Jong, my designer, you know, I'm trying to create an arena in which people can create, in which there can be spontaneity, and I suppose in a way, a little bit of chaos. But I have to be very controlled about the packets in which that's delivered, if you see what I mean, all the different segments of the film, because I want to feel a sense of control on the wider narrative. Mm. So in a way, I try to very tightly control the pace of shooting. Mm-hmm. You know, we stay on schedule or ahead of schedule. We stay on budget or under budget. Those are the kind of, you know, parameters that I always want in place. And then within that, you want things to take their own path. You want actors to come to set with surprises for you. You want the different creatives that you're working with, all these wonderful people. You want them to surprise you and challenge you and maybe make a little bit of chaos on a particular day and then, you know, pull something out of that. But my job is to keep the spine of the thing, the guardrails of the thing in place.
The fact that you place so much emphasis on shooting practically as well allows you to do that. But it also allows those happy accidents. You know, I always think about Raiders of the Lost Ark, the swordsman sequence, for example.
Down to diarrhea.
Absolutely. If Harrison hadn't had diarrhea, that sequence would have been very, very, very different indeed.
Exactly.
Were there accidents, not like that, but were there accidents on this movie?
I think accidents is maybe an unfortunate term.
Yes, I realized
diarrhea,
that.
But yes.
As I backed into that sentence, I realized that.
We traveled the world. There were a few moments. Definitely. I mean, of course, what you're talking about historically, and it's one of the most sort of famous examples of adaptation to circumstance. Mm. And when you get out of the studio, you go around the world, you're constantly adapting to circumstance, you know, whether it's the weather, you know, just logistical difficulties, that kind of thing. There's always stuff. There's always things you're dealing with that forces you in particular directions.
The ocean, for example.
The ocean, very much. And, we knew going in, I mean, I was getting calls back in Los Angeles where we prepped the whole film. I was getting calls about the beach in Morocco where we were going to shoot, that the waves were pounding and they were going to destroy the set and there was bad weather coming in and maybe we should delay a couple of weeks. And, I called everybody up who was there and I was like, well, we want bad weather. Like, that's... You know, we're trying to show the wrath of the gods, the wrath of Poseidon and everything. So if we can find a way to safely film, we're there for the filthy weather. Like, we're not there for a bright blue sky and a calm ocean. You know, we want to challenge these things. So you're kind of, you're building in the opportunity to react to things when you embrace, you know, getting out and shooting in the real world.
And talking of building the story and writing the screenplay, it's fascinating. Obviously, we won't go into detail, but you again play with chronology in this movie. You play with time, which is something that has fascinated you throughout your career. Mm. Was that something that was always in your mind when you sat down to write the screenplay, or was it something that happened naturally?
Well, the crazy thing is, I mean, I've spent, you know, decades doing interviews like this. I'm often asked about nonlinear narratives. I'm often asked about my approach to time. So, of course, then you go to the oldest, you know, foundational text of all of Western literature, and it has the most radical nonlinear structure you'd ever encounter. It's stories within stories, it's flashbacks within flashbacks. And there's something pretty humbling about that, because you go, this is not a new idea in literature. This is, in fact, the oldest idea.
Yeah.
And so the structure of the poem is extraordinary. And as a screenwriter, you just grab that. I mean, yes, there's a lot of challenges to adapting Homer, but the challenges are very much enjoyed. The structure was not one of them. The structure is there for the taking. It's like, yes, it's a tale about storytelling. It's flashbacks within flashbacks. It's beautifully structured. And so I tried to follow that as best I could.
And use the construct of storytelling itself as a trigger for a lot less flashbacks, which again is inherent in the poem.
Yeah, exactly. And the manner of storytelling is part of it, and the emotional effect of storytelling and mythologizing about these characters. I mean, with Tom Holland's character of Telemachus, you're dealing with a kid who idolizes this parent that they've never actually met. They don't have a conscious memory of this. And so, he's learned of his father through the mythology, through the songs and all the rest. And of course, that informs Tom's relationship with Anne Hathaway, who's playing Penelope, because of course, she's missing the love of her life, who's a real person, a real man that she knows is just a human being and is not the mythic figure of the tales that her son has grown up on. It creates a marvelous tension between those characters.
Indeed. It's a film that is preoccupied with a lot of things. Loyalty is one of them. And it strikes me, again, you seem to be a very, very loyal person. You work with a lot of the same crew members again and again, a lot of the same cast members again and again. Once you're in the Chris Nolan Club, you can get that invitation at any time. When do you know you're clicking with an actor? And maybe you thinking, you know, Matt, for example.
Well, I mean, it's a fair question. With actors, particularly movie stars, and Matt is a wonderful movie star as well as being a phenomenally talented actor. I mean, he's a legend. And when I first, you know, called him up and I talked to him on the phone, I'd met him very, very briefly, I think at an award show or something, you know, just to say hello to. But, you know, I actually called him up, sent him the script for Interstellar, you know, convinced him to do this very, very small part, uncredited as well.
Yes.
But he and I, we just hit it off immediately in a creative sense. I mean, obviously in a friend sense as well. He's a lovely guy, very easygoing. I mean, he gets along with everybody. But in a creative sense, you start speaking the same language immediately. You just start talking about what movies are and about storytelling, and you realize that you have a commonality, that you have a shared passion for it. You see things in the same way, and that gives you a confidence that you should be pulling in the same direction. You don't need that with everybody you work with. Mm. I'm happy to work with actors or anyone on the crew, frankly, but actors in particular who have a very different view of what a movie is, or, you know, coming to that. And that gives you a very different influence. I think in the case of The Odyssey, it was so important to have somebody leading the charge from the cast point of view, who we were completely on the same page with about the mechanics of filmmaking, about why we were doing what we were doing, because Matt understands more than anybody what's going on the set. And he understood my approach. Mm. He fully embraced my approach. And so when we're out there pitching waves with the whole cast out and, you know, this boat, everyone's starting to feel a bit sick and whatever, he knows why we're there. So he's on board. I'm not having to convince him, and he's leading from the front. It's wonderful to have a creative partner like that.
Are you on that boat as well, or you want to slap a separate boat?
No, I'm on that
being
boat.
Being similarly sick.
I'm on that boat. Okay. I actually find it, you know, I learned on Dunkirk, I actually have pretty good sea legs. So it wasn't so bad. But from a director point of view, I don't use the monitor very much. And that's the key. If you look at a monitor on a pitching boat, you will get sick immediately. But if you're out, you know, watching to eye and seeing what Hoyt is doing, he's just got the handheld IMAX camera there, and we're out there just enjoying it. It was intense, but we knew we were getting special things. I mean, there's a shot in the film where Odysseus is, you know, on the boat and you see these dolphins playing in the waves. It's a very rough day. And I'm sure everyone will just figure that they're CG dolphins or whatever, but they're not, they're real. And, you know, working with Hoyt, working with Matt, it was like, okay, there's some dolphins. Let's grab the shot, you know, and you just get all the elements in play for that. And you can only really do that with people who are very, very excited and enthusiastic about the approach you're taking.
Your casting instinct is so strong. I remember talking to Cillian Murphy about, you know, the meeting for Oppenheimer where you showed up with the script and went off and walked around Dublin for a bit while he read the script. So that meant you had him in mind for that. And did you have Matt in mind as you were writing this, or did he begin to pop into view?
I didn't have Cillian in mind while I was writing, and I didn't have Matt in mind when I was writing this, because when you're writing, as a writer-director, you have to be very disciplined with this, I think. I mean, everybody does it differently. For my process, if I'm writing, I'm trying to discover the full potential of the characters on the page. And if I have an actor in mind, like if I'd been thinking of Cillian while I was writing Oppenheimer, I would have limited the character.
Yeah.
Inherently, you start writing to what you've seen the actor do. And that becomes limiting because what you're actually looking to do with the character is present them with a challenge. You know, I want to put a script in front of Matt Damon that says, I know you can do this, but I want you to read it and think that maybe you can't. You know, I want you to be seeing things in this character that you haven't played before and that are going to challenge you.
That's interesting. Because obviously that's a world away from something like Batman Begins, where that was a whole casting process and you have all sorts of screen tests and chemistry tests and you're looking at a lot of people for the role of Bruce Wayne and Batman. And now you are, once you get the screenplay finished, and you are searing in on one person that you know or you hope can do it.
Partly, if I'm to be totally honest, a lot of the screen testing process and chemistry tests and so forth, at least for me, a lot of that was for other people, for the studio, for the, you know.
To reassure them.
Yeah, I hadn't done those kind of films before.
Of course.
We were casting a very, very important character. I mean, to put, you know, Christian Bale in the Batsuit, that's 3 movies, 10 years worth of, you know, they're one of the most important characters. And so, yeah, you're going through a process that is important for the whole machine around you. But as I've been more liberated from that, I get to trust my own instincts more. And of course, one of the things about casting that people forget is when you're looking at actors of the highest level, movie stars, people you know, all the rest, they can all do the job.
Yeah.
That's not the question. The question is, are they the right fit for this film? Can you help them as a director to give of their best and do something extraordinary? And that's really down to how I feel about working with that person, what I could do with them. It's not about testing them to say sort of, you know, do they have the skills? They all have the skills, you know? Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, it's really about me and what, you know, I knew that working with Cillian Murphy, I could bring out his Oppenheimer in a really cool way.
Yeah.
And I felt the same thing with Matt and Odysseus very strongly. Like, yeah, I knew he's at a time in his career and life where he gets this character and he can just, I mean, he just killed it.
How hands-on are you as a director in terms of in between takes, taking actors aside and finessing what they're doing?
I'm as hands-on or not as I need to be. Yeah. I mean, there are actors who I don't talk to at all because it's not going to help them and they don't need that. There are actors I have long, very in-depth conversations with all the time throughout. My job is to be whatever director they need me to be, to feel comfortable and to do what they're going to do. And one of the really fun things about working with actors is they're all different. They all require different things.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, the great actors, when they come together, like when you're filming a two-shot, and they each have a different process, but they somehow accommodate each other's process. They somehow find the way to play the scene together.
Have you had acting lessons to have an insight into actors' minds?
No. My uncle, who just passed away last year, he was an actor, a very good actor, and taught acting. And I put him in my first film, Following. Yeah. He plays the policeman who's interviewing the protagonist throughout. And I went to him at the beginning and said, look, what do I need to know? And he said, you don't want to overthink it. He gave me a couple of books to read, Stanislavski, you know, just to get the basics of what's the process, the difference between, you know, externally indicating an emotion or believing it and thinking it and playing it in the moment. And he pointed out to me that beyond that, it's really down to me and finding a working relationship with the actors. So I've not burrowed too deep on it, and that served me well.
Interesting.
I'm fascinated by actors. I love their process. I love helping their process, but I don't tread on their toes because I don't claim to know how they do what they do.
So you're not offering Matt Damon line readings, for example.
I'm trying to not offer anybody line readings. Is that you really know you failed when you find yourself. And it, for anybody who's ever tried to direct, it's like the one thing for us non-actors that's an absolute is you'll have an idea in your head of how a line's going to be said. And there have been times in my career where out of frustration, I will then go, well, okay, and I'll try to give the line reading. And somehow you are completely incapable of getting what's in your head to come out of your mouth in anything like what you wanted it to be. And that's very humbling. You just go, yeah, there is a mystical element
mm-hmm.
to acting. It is a magical process. It connects our most human empathetic responses in ways that we're really not able to analyze consciously.
Mm.
And that's what keeps it fascinating. And that's what keeps us as viewers. It keeps us really compelled by these movie stars, these incredible performers.
Can we talk about the most difficult casting search on this movie, though, which I imagine was the dog, Argus?
It was brutal. Yeah, you feel bad enough when you're auditioning actors and there's a line of people, you know, dressed in the same suit sitting outside or whatever, and you know that one of them or whatever. With the dogs, you know, they just brought a couple dogs in and the dogs come up and kind of nuzzle you like, choose me, choose me. And there's one I was like, oh yeah, this dog would be great. And then, you know, Sawyer, our dog who plays Argus came in and immediately I was like, oh no. This is the dog. And of course, I've got this other dog like nuzzling up against me still with his eyes saying, you know, I want to go to Sicily, please put me in the movie. And in front of him, you literally have to choose the one over the other. No, it was absolutely brutal.
I won't go into specifics for obvious reasons. I'm going to let people discover this themselves. But there are moments and sequences in this film that for me felt as close as we have got to a Chris Nolan horror film.
Don't frighten people.
No,
we want people to come to the movie.
I am a horror nut.
Not everybody is, though.
This is true. That is true. Was that something that you wanted to add to your bag of tricks, almost?
Well, I mean, in a way, I've always been interested in doing a horror film, but horror is most successful when the conceptual framework of whatever the story is just so undeniable, you know, and I think there are very few really great horror movies. I've never clicked with a particular idea or concept that worked for me.
Okay.
But I love the genre and I love the fact that of all genres, it's the most visceral. It's the most where the direct response to the audience is the most important.
Yes.
That is to say, you're trying to make people literally feel something in their bones about what's going on screen. It's also the genre in which, you know, experimentation is demanded. So, you know, I go to see a lot of horror films, you know, with my kids and stuff these days, and you'll see things in the first half an hour, 45 minutes of any horror film that you would never see in another genre.
Yeah.
Risks that are taken, you know, dangerous approaches to things and all the rest. Admittedly, a lot of movies can't sustain that till the end, mm-hmm. but in the horror genre, that kind of innovation is not just respected, it's really demanded. And I'm talking in the audiovisual sense, the imagery people get to play with and the sounds and so forth. So it's a really cool space.
And you're playing with some really nice notions here as well. There's some really arresting images and...
Well, you've got, you know, Homer and you've got these stories and a lot of the Odyssey is based on horror, or I should say the other way around.
Yeah.
A lot of horror tropes, you know, come from things like the Odyssey when you're talking about the transformation of, you know, men into pigs and things like that. You know, that comes from Greek mythology. And to kind of find a way to visualize that in the modern world. You know, I certainly spent a lot of time with my team looking at, you know, I come from that really cool era of like 80s, you know, transformation movies with incredible technology by, you know, geniuses like Rick Baker and Rob Bottin. And, you know, you really felt like we wanted to get back to that era of tactility in visual effects. And we wanted to try and add something to it. And really provide a technology. And I challenged my team to come up with a technology that could be driven by performance so that rather than telling the actor, in this case, Samantha Morton playing Cersei,
mm-hmm.
she's an incredible actor. I've wanted to work with her a long time. I didn't want her have to turn up on set and tell her exactly where to stand or exactly how to do things. We wanted to come up with an approach to that sequence where she could lead it, her performance could lead it. And it was really, really thrilling, thrilling stuff to shoot, I have to say.
Rick Baker and Rob Bottin is exactly who I was thinking of in that sequence as well. It's astonishing, absolutely astonishing.
Well, thank you.
And you have the title card at the beginning, A Time of Apparent Magic, seems to apply to the filmmaking process as well.
Yeah, I mean, a certain amount of double meaning going on with that title. But yeah, it's for me, the thing about movies is it is a magical medium. And you are putting on a show and you are trying to trick the audience, but you're also trying to involve them in the trick and have them enjoy the trick. And that's part of it.
On that note, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
All right, that was Christopher Nolan talking about The Odyssey. What a joy that was. And we'll get on to the film in a second, because now it is time for the reviews section of the show. But there are some other films that have ventured, perhaps foolishly, into the cinemas and onto the sofaplexes this week. Fine for your viewing hours with The Odyssey. Hellspells, what are they, and should we waste any time on them?
Honestly, probably not, but with a caveat. So one of the films out this week is Heartstopper Forever.
Oh,
yes, which stars Joe Locke and Kit Connor, directed by Wash Westmoreland. And this is the feature-length finale to Heartstopper, the TV show. So they're calling it a film, but I will be honest, it does feel like a feature-length episode of the TV show. It's all your favorite characters back. They're basically now in their last year at school. They're about to head off to university. They're figuring out how to deal with that seismic shift. You know, how to kind of cope with their relationships. How do they keep going?
I don't know anything about Heartstopper. So who are these people? What do they do?
They're kids. They're just kids who are just dealing with sexuality, relationships. You know, teenage drama.
Sex and death.
Essentially that. No death.
Oh.
I mean, spoilers, I guess, but no death.
Okay.
But no, it's just like it's a nice group of young people who are doing their best to figure things out. I don't want to say too much more than that, because I don't want to get into giving away who's seeing who and who breaks up with who, because some people break up and will they get back together? Who knows?
My God.
But look, they're a really likable bunch. They do good jobs. If you haven't watched the TV show, this will be Greek to you reference another film out this week. But it's perfectly well done. They all, you know, it's nice. This barely qualifies as a film. This is probably a pilot plus kind of a deal. But it is out this week.
Yeah, and it's feature length.
And it's feature length, so we're counting it.
Yeah.
So I think for me, this would be like a classic, probably 3 stars. Totally,
and if you watch the series, you will absolutely watch it. And if you don't watch the series, you absolutely won.
If you watch the series, you'd probably add a star, I guess. I
would say. So this is the Peaky Blinders, the Immortal Man of Heartstopper.
I mean, basically,
yes. Yeah, basically.
Okay. So would I, because I watched that Peaky Blinders movie having never seen a second of Peaky Blinders.
You'll love this.
So if I watched Heartstopper Forever, would I get it? Would I get the gist? Would I understand?
They will sort of set up who's who and who's dating who and all the rest. But it may take a bit of
investment in the characters. I don't know that there's any point.
Okay.
This is probably not the place to start.
All right, 3 stars in for Heartstopper Forever. What else?
Well, there is Couples Weekend, which is written and directed by Nora Kirkpatrick of US Office fame. And this sees Alexandra Daddario and Josh Gad as two best friends who take their respective partners, played by David Diggs and Ashley Park, for a couples weekend away to celebrate New Year's in a kind of remote cabin. But don't worry, nobody gets murdered by a serial killer. What does happen is they get snowed in by a blizzard, which is particularly unfortunate because Daddario and Gad discover that their respective partners are having an illicit liaison, or have an illicit encounter at least, and then they're snowed in and have to deal with the consequences. And look, this film is not particularly good. I think it is particularly unfortunate that it follows on the footsteps of The Invite, which deals with this territory exquisitely. And this is so kind of like, it feels so rudimentary by comparison. It's just basically people shouting at each other and getting drunk and occasionally dancing in the living room. I don't think it has anything particularly meaningful to say about the stagnation of relationships. And I was really disappointed by it, if I'm honest with you, because actually, from a setup point of view, it has a lot of potential. So I think even if you take The Invite situation out of it, it's just a bit 2 stars, a bit flat, a bit bland, and a bit boring.
It feels stagey at times. It feels like overly mannered.
Yep.
There are moments where you're like, oh, that was a good moment. But that's basically all it really has.
And there aren't many of those.
Yeah, afraid not. So honestly, there's one film this week that you should be thinking about.
And that's Little Brother, which debuted a couple of weeks ago on Netflix. Eric Andre gate crashes John Cena's life with hilarious consequences.
It's fine.
He pisses in his own mouth and John Cena gets his bumhole licked. That's all you need to know. Five stars in for Little Brother. And
Christopher Nolan has just turned this off.
That is actually accurate for Little Brother, but that's not a recommendation.
What do you mean? Did you not hear what I just said? Eric Andre pisses in his own mouth and John Cena gets his bumhole licked.
Anyway.
The Odyssey is Christopher Nolan's epic adaptation of the Homer poem. Who better to discuss this movie than these three fucking idiots assembled before me? Who wants to talk about this movie first?
I must insist that Helen review it, but she do the whole thing in dactylic hexameter.
No, because I can't, you see, because I read the Emily Wilson translation, which, as we all know, is an iambic pentameter.
Oh, what a cop-out.
Because dactylic hexameter is just a faff.
I love them in Star Trek, though. All right. Hellspells, as our resident historian and pedant.
And this is, and I cannot emphasize this enough, not history, but no. Carry on.
Hey! There is evidence that there was a Troy that was destroyed by war around the right time. Like, there is historiness.
Sure. The to some monsters of this. And the nymphs and the
Homer's
cyclops.
Odyssey is part of human history.
Yes.
It's part of Greek mythology. Carry on.
His story. If you will.
Michael Jackson.
It's an odd story. Yeah. Anyway, this is the story of Odysseus, who is played by Matt Damon. One of the leaders of the Greeks during the Trojan War. He is the guy who came up with the idea of the horse, which allowed them to basically win the Trojan War. You'll see why in the film. And
spoiler.
He then sails home and gets waylaid by various things en route.
And you moan when we're late for this podcast. I put it to you, we have never been 2 decades late to record. It may have felt that way, but we have never been 20 years late.
It has frequently felt that way. To be fair, he's only 10 years late. It was a 10-year war.
Yeah, it was a 10-year war, then a 10-year journey.
Anyway, so basically, that is no spoilers. This is like the most established thing in the world, that it takes Odysseus a really long time to get home to Penelope, the Anne Hathaway character, and Telemachus, the Tom Holland character. And in the meantime, she is under siege, essentially, from suitors
like
who want her to remarry and take one of them because they basically want her money. And also, she's hot. She's Anne Hathaway. and they are led by Corey Hawkins and Robert Pattinson as the two biggest dickheads you've ever seen in your life.
Dickheadus, I think, is actually one of their names, right?
The Corey Hawkins character, I think, is,
Dickheadus and Twatus.
Because dickers.
Definitely not, actually. I don't get that energy from them, even slightly. Basically, that's it. And it's, as you would expect from Chris Nolan, it's not told in a linear fashion. There are sort of flashbacks within stories, within flashbacks in this film. It's meandering in a way that I think does honor to its hero, and it's absolutely fucking brilliant. I really want to get into this in ways that I shouldn't because it's a spoiler, but it is off the charts incredible. It is an overwhelming cinema experience. I highly recommend seeing it on IMAX, ideally on the biggest IMAX that you can get to. I was physically and emotionally and just like narratively, cinematographically shook by it. I think it's brilliant. And I have not always been the most in the bag for Christopher Nolan. A Christopher Nolan Dictionary by Helen O'Hara out next year.
What changed? What changed, Helen? Can you pinpoint the exact moment that you began to warm to the works of Christopher Nolan?
How long did it take the check to clear?
No, look, but I like going back and rewatching all the films for that did give me an appreciation of things that I had previously dismissed, I will say. But also this film, I fucking loved. This is so my jam, I can't even tell you. I have been reading the Iliad and the Odyssey in preparation for this.
Nerd.
I know. I know. And so I can tell you that like this is so rooted in Bronze Age history and mythology. It's off the charts. There is a concept in this. People talk about the sea people. This is a thing that like the sources talk about. It's not particularly in Homer. He hasn't got that from the Odyssey itself, but he's taken it from other sources around the same time. Like there's so much of this kind of gnarly detail to this that doesn't even just come from Homer itself, but like he's gone out, he's done the research across all of the sources from the time and brought elements of that in. He has, as I really should maybe have expected, dialed down the gods stuff.
Yeah. He's Nolanized it.
He's Nolanized it quite a bit in that sense. But, you know, what I didn't trust him initially to do when this was announced was he still has fucking monsters. He still has fucking giants. He has not tried to find ways to kind of rationalize his way out the more fantastical elements. This is still a fantastical journey across not just the Mediterranean, but he clearly goes a long way further than that.
560 nautical miles. I'm just saying.
Look, I thought you were going to give it 560 stars.
I would, maybe. I think it's off.
You'd give it 560
stars. 560
stars.
No, I'm kidding. I'm only slightly exaggerating.
You've got to leave room for Dune Part 3 to go somewhere.
That's true. But I will say also, what I think is really interesting is, you know, it might take a minute in this to kind of get into the way people are speaking. Like, I think especially like Tom Holland's character and there's a little bit of this in Anne Hathaway's character as well, and Penelope, they sometimes don't speak in an entirely natural way. There's an element of them not speechifying. They're not talking like Shakespearean, and it's all very natural language. But there's an element where it's kind of at a slight remove from everyday speech. And I really, really like that about it. Yeah.
Because at one point, Telemachus refers to Odysseus as dad.
Yeah.
And I think he says mom at one point. Nolan has made the decision to have every character in this speak with American accents.
Yeah.
Which I know some people, certainly when the trailers came out,
I hated it in the trailer.
Okay, so what changed in the film?
It worked in the film.
I think you get over it very quickly. The dad thing I bumped on briefly, but I think that's only because I bumped on it in the trailer and it just reminded me of that. But I think you get used to it. Also, I can't speak for Christopher Nolan, but it feels incredibly deliberate as a commentary on kind of fading American colonialism. And I feel like he very much, instead of choosing everyone to just use a mid-Atlantic or English accent, it's very clearly an American accent. And I don't think that's accidental. But also, it doesn't take you out of the film at all. And I would say it's not what you would call the plottiest story, right? I think there are elements of it, certainly towards the end, where it becomes slightly more political and there's more plot going on. But it isn't. It is a kind of, it's told in sort of nested stories within stories. It's recounted by different parties to other parties. What Odysseus' exploits were kind of post Troy, and it's one thing after another, but essentially it is man tries to get home. Like, that's basically the story. But it's about the texture and the feeling of being there. There's a really desaturated kind of palette to it. The whole thing feels kind of as if you've washed up on a shore. You can almost feel the brine on your skin throughout the whole thing. It's a very singular experience. It is also nearly 3 hours long. It is also punishingly dour, I would say. I don't say that as a criticism, but I do think it won't be for everyone because it's quite a lot as an experience.
There were at least two laughs.
Were there? No, I mean, it's a Christopher Nolan film. It's not a laugh a minute, but that's not what it's supposed to be. It's an extraordinary, I think, interpretation of that material, and it maintains the kind of epic majesty of the story while making it feel contemporary as well. And the fact that kind of he pivots from a number of different genres, it's been talked about, but the Samantha Morton scene in this is basically a mini horror film in the middle of it. It's really powerful, really well done. It's a great film. My main criticisms of it, I think, would be my favourite act was the last act. I think The Homecoming is actually the best part of the film. But I think there are a couple of storytelling moments that are unclear. And I won't talk about it until the spoiler special, but there's one in particular that I've discussed with everyone who's seen the film, and literally no one I've spoken to understands it.
I think I got it on the second viewing.
Okay, good. So well, let's catch up after again.
I watched it twice yesterday, which was quite an intense day.
Oh, like I did with Predators. Predators! Predators!
Badlands.
That is a lot. 6 hours of the day was spent in the Ionian Sea.
Wow. Yep. You really are in the pocket of Big Nolan now. This is incredible. Alex, what did you think about this? Did you think this movie landed emotionally? Because this is, I think, a movie that will surprise people. And there's lots of scale and spectacle. But I don't want to give too much away, but if you know the story, you know that it ends quite intimately. And it's going for big emotional beats at the end of the story. Did you think it landed? for you?
Yeah, I know first of all, I won't discuss it, but the way it ends actually is emotional in a way that I didn't expect. It's something that Nolan, I think, brings to the material and contemporizes it. But yes, it is. I'll tell you what, I absolutely love the film. I've seen it twice. The second time was last night. I would happily watch it again tonight. It is, to coin a modern phrase, absolute cinema. It is really so much cinema and so awesome in the true sense of the word. And as I was watching it for 2 hours and 52 minutes the second time last night, and this is going to sound like hyperbole, and maybe it is, but in that moment, I did think, no one else can do this as well as he is doing it, to the level that he is delivering it. I just thought, this is just as good as this sort of entertainment gets. It is emotional, but I think more in a very touching, sort of stirring way. It's not emotional in the way that Interstellar is for me, which really pushes my buttons and leaves me an emotional wreck. But I think it works. And it does it all really naturally. And I think that's one of the biggest things it manages to pull off, because it is by its nature episodic. There are stories within stories, and it's like, oh, they're going to do this now, and then they're going to meet this monster, and this is going to happen, and now these people are going to turn up, and then this is going to happen, and a lot of it you know. But it feels so fluid somehow, because of the way he structures it and because of the way he grounds it in the drama and the emotion. It feels propulsive. You never feel like it's not moving forward and it's not telling one story, even though there's so much going on.
The editing, I think, is astonishing. I think especially those first sort of 15, 20 minutes where you're setting up everybody and all of these stories are nested within each other and you're having all these flashes from one person to this person they're talking about and that kind of thing. I think the editing in that section is off the charts great. I really, really loved it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we thought he was going to do the monsters. Like you say, Helen, we were hoping he wouldn't shy away from it, and he absolutely doesn't. But I will say he does some of the things that you might know about if you read the book or if you know what happens in such a natural way and in such a human way. He does things that in one sense are understated, but on the other hand, completely powerful and affecting. Mm. He does things that could have been distasteful very, very tastefully. I think he's done it all really, really delicately. It's an amazing thing to do something so famous and something so massive and potentially unfilmable in a way that feels like it all makes sense.
Yeah. It's a really clever adaptation as well. He's left out basically the boring islands, and he's taken bits of those that were maybe important or interesting and reused them in different ways. And I loved that about it. Again, the textual richness of this is off the charts. I'm really, really glad I just read The Odyssey is not the thing I thought I would say, but I really am. It was it was super, super rooted in that, but also not afraid to bring in some, you know, psychological insight and some depth and to develop the characters in a way that was not necessarily the case always in the poem, but also to lean into the characters in the poem in a way you might not expect, you know. So Telemachus in the poem is, you know, prone to tearing up and getting upset by things and feels really frustrated and isn't a particularly good fighter and worries about how he can make a difference in the world. And that's all kind of there, even though it's Tom Holland and we know him as Spider-Man. Do you know what I mean? So they've kind of kept some of the stuff that maybe isn't even fashionable for nowadays and brought that up today.
Well, he imbues it with meaning and purpose. Mm. And I don't know the book, but it feels like to me that he has made it personal. You know, there is stuff on Christopher Nolan's mind that he has put into this film, and he has given it weight and meaning. And I just want to, just one other thing I want to say about it is the casting is amazing. We knew who was in it. We knew it was this massive band of A-listers, but everyone is so perfectly suited to the person, and everyone plays to each actor's strengths, I think.
What about Matt Damon? How does he fare for you? Because he was, I think he's interesting casting because he's, you know, he's obviously adept at playing people who are trying to find their way home. That's something that's in his wheelhouse. But when he was cast, he doesn't strike me. Yes, he's Jason Bourne, but he's not a man mountain. And for some reason, I always had this image of Odysseus as someone who was a big, tall,
I never
brawny.
Saw him that way.
He's not meant to be
not
tall,
preacher,
but he is meant to be broad.
Yeah, someone who's, you know, and obviously Matt Damon's bulked up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I think he's fantastic in this. Mm. I think he's absolutely terrific. But did he land for you as, you know, this guy who is suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder?
Absolutely. I think he really grounds it. He's the focus point for the whole thing. And actually what's really interesting about his role is it is, despite the weight of this whole universe of Homer's Odyssey being on Matt Damon's shoulders on screen, it's not a showy performance. No. And there are much sort of bigger and broad, like successfully bigger and broader performances in the film. Like Robert Pattinson is incredible. I was saying to someone this morning, he is, broadly speaking, the villain of the piece, right? But, and he's having so much fun with it, but he does it in such a brilliantly nuanced way. It's a fine line. Like you tip it 5 degrees in the wrong direction and he could be sort of campy and moustache twirling, but he keeps that at bay and mm-hmm. it's like this delicious thing that he does. But Matt Damon isn't clearly having as much fun. He's just doing a really, really brilliant job at anchoring everything,
mm.
yet still with a load of charisma. And no, he might not be a man mountain. He's pretty fucking ripped.
I mean, yeah, you wouldn't mess with him. He's not quite Ralph Fiennes in The Return, no. to be fair. He doesn't have that physique. But yeah, I think he fits it very well. Really, I like one of the things that struck me on this, and it's not just the IMAX of it, is that Nolan has such an eye for these incredibly arresting shots and moments. And there's a particular scene in this with Agamemnon, played by Benny Safdie. And you've seen him in the trailer. He has an extraordinary, I would say his outfit, but his whole demeanor, his whole presence, the whole sort of vision of Agamemnon. And look, if I start dressing like that in the office, you'll all understand, right? Because I think I could pull that off.
I mean, yeah, that is maybe my favorite visual from the film is just Agamemnon. And in particular, at a certain moment that we're not even going to talk about, he's absolutely fucking terrifying. He is a beast.
And he's Benny Safdie.
Yeah.
We have a rival for Aragorn in terms of best door opening, is all I'm saying.
It's, yeah, it really is.
I don't think
well,
it's
he has people. He has
Aragorn.
People open the door for him.
Of course he does. He's a king.
It's not as sexy. I want to be very clear on that.
It's not as sexy. It's pretty fucking sexy.
Oh, boy.
We should also talk about, because I completely forgot to mention them, and I think in some ways, one of these characters in particular is key to the heart of the movie, John Leguizamo, who's terrific as Eumaeus, who is a sheep herder who's very, very faithful to Odysseus and stays the course over the years that he's gone, and Himesh Patel, who is Eurylochus, who is his second in command, and both of them, I think, are examining the concept of loyalty in very interesting ways, and both are terrific in this, and shouldn't be overlooked, I think, in the rush to mention the A-listers, which is exactly what we did a few minutes ago. But they're both great.
There are so many people in it.
So many people in it.
Yeah,
there
are
all people. Leguizamo, I think, is a beautiful performance and maybe one of the most sympathetic in the film. Incredible.
Absolutely.
We should shout out, by the way, you're talking about composition and whatnot and editing. We haven't mentioned the editor is Jennifer Lame, who is his long-standing editor, cinematographer, of course, long-standing cinematographer, Hoyt van Hoytema. Great score by Ludwig Göransson as well.
Off the chart score, actually.
Incredible.
It's really out there. It's very different from anything you might expect.
It's on another plane. I mean, I don't even know how those sounds.
No idea.
That.
Yeah. Extraordinary score.
Ruth de Jong, production designer. But this is a Chris Nolan film. Absolutely. Every frame is suffused with his unique, inimitable Nolanosity. We've given it 5 stars. Would you say that's fair? Would you agree? Would you concur?
I mean, yeah, I guess. If there are no more available.
Helen would give it 5 + 555 more. Jimbo, would you concur?
Yes, I would say it is unarguably a 5-star film. I'm not sure that it's right up there with my top Nolan films, but it's a fucking good film. And I would say at this point in the year, it is the film of the year.
5 stars then for Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey. We'll be doing a couple of spoiler specials for this. We'll be doing an immediate reaction show, which will hopefully be up on Friday. We're recording it tomorrow. Helen will not be there for that one. She's boning up in her books, but she will be back for Lee. Yes. She'll be back for Lee next one as well, which will be Helen banging on about all the things they got wrong.
I'm not, like, I will say, like, if you are a nerd, like, he's not going for absolute historical accuracy.
No.
Like, the costumes are very much in the vein of inspired by, you know, the way, like, Elizabeth Taylor's Cleopatra costumes looked suspiciously 60s. That's fine.
That's fine.
But I may, I'm going to try not to talk about earring backs and how much they annoyed me. But I'm,
if you
I'm
do,
really going to try.
I will press a button and the button will go.
Okay. And just like,
no, I'm not going to electric shock you. Okay, that would be fucking
just,
inhumane. What do you think
just
I am?
Buzz at me.
Oh my God. I'm a monster.
You're a monster.
And on that note, I think that is it for this week's Emperor Podcast. Join us next week for more film related fun, where we'll be joined by the aforementioned Tom Hiddleston, who'll be talking about his television show, James. What's happening? The streams are being crossed.
Yes. Why on earth would you cover a television show that takes you on a holiday to Bombay? I don't understand. It makes no sense.
I had deep fried pizza that blew.
We will deep fry your pizza.
It blew my mind and blocked my arteries, and I regret nothing. It was absolutely incredible. Yeah. Anyway, Tom Hiddleston will be on the show next week to talk about that. In terms of yes, indeed. In terms of other interview things, I should say that we have an Odyssey interview special with Matt Damon and Tom Holland and Himesh Patel and John Leguizamo as well, talking about the Odyssey. And we'll have another episode of the interviews next week as well with the likes of Mary Steenburgen. And we will also be putting up, oh my God, am I going to get time to do all this? When I was in LA, not only did I go to the Digger Trailer event and hang out with Mr. Cruz, I also did two separate one-hour interviews. Friday was a busy day for me. I went to Scott Aukerman's studio to sit down with the creator and host of my favorite podcast of all time, the Empire Podcast. Comedy Bang Bang, which is an amazing, amazing improv comedy podcast. If you've never heard it, listen to it. It is incredible. And we chatted for an hour. They're coming to the UK next week, the Comedy Bang Bang All-Stars. They're going to be playing dates in London, Bristol, Leeds, Manchester, Glasgow and Dublin. I will be at the Dublin show. If you see me and my wife there, come and say hello. It'll be, and we will scowl and run away. But that was a great interview with Scott Aukerman. Thank you, Scott, for being so generous with your time. And I also sat down for an hour in his office with John motherfucking Woo. Who has a season dedicated to him and his movies, mainly his Hong Kong action cinema heroic bloodshed movies, things like The Killer and Bullet in the Head and Hard Boiled and A Better Tomorrow 1 and 2, but also the likes of Face Off and Hard Target and Red Cliff, both parts of Red Cliff as well. No Mission Impossible 2, no Wind Talkers, no Paycheck, but you can't have everything. That's on the BFI South Bank. It's called The Films of John Woo, Bullets and Brotherhood. Tickets for all of those screenings, some of which will be introduced by people who are not me, you'll be delighted to know, are on sale right now at bfi.org.uk. And those interviews will be up as soon as I am humanly capable of doing so. But that is it definitely now for this week's Emperor Podcast. Thank you as ever and goodbye to my three colleagues of such lethal cunning. Goodbye, Alex Godfrey.
Bye.
Goodbye, James.
Goodbye, Chris.
Goodbye, Helen.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye for me as well. I am off to the Roosevelt's website, RSVLTS, to buy a golf polo shirt that they have called simply The Grant. It is inspired by Sam Neill as Alan Grant in Jurassic Park. I've had it in my basket for weeks and I've not pulled the trigger.
Do it.
And now is the time. If it's sold out, I'm not going to be happy. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.